Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Hey, good morning, Vachon. It's August 2nd. We've made it past the July heat wave, and now we're entering the last official month of summer. Glad you could join us and make us part of your day on the Brown Briefly. Thanks always to Brian Brown for his creation of this wonderful opportunity for us to come together every week and talk about the events of the day on Vachon and around the world and occasionally across the galaxy. So today there are five of us, and our tried and true team of Truman O'Brien, Bruce Hallman, and now Craig Bellis is added to the lineup. Gentlemen, I'm glad to see you're all here today. How's it going?
Good morning. Good morning.
Going well. Thank you.
Great. Right. It's not Bruce. 90 degrees.
Yeah, hallelujah, brother.
Thank goodness. Whatever we need to thank, and we need to keep working on that. We also joining us today, Seth Zuckerman, who is with the Northwest Natural Resources Group. And Seth is the, as I understand it, the president of the Water District 19 Board, and is here for our small talk session. Seth, did I get all that right?
Just right. Yes. Thanks for having me today.
Absolutely. And how are you doing, by the way?
Cooling off. It's a relief.
You know, it seems like universal truth. I mean, I'm a Northwest native, so I always, you know, my internal thermometer was set to meltdown whenever it got to 80 degrees. I think that the thermostat is adjusting slightly, so meltdown is now more like 95 or 90. But yeah, for folks like me, fortunately, I do have a heat pump, so the house stays cool. So given the heat is behind us, how did people fare? How did we weather through the heat? Bruce, how was Ellisport, and how did you deal with the heat? I saw you out on the docks at one point trying to keep cool. What else were you able to do?
Yeah, in any time you can get around the water in the Pacific Northwest, it helps. And KVI Beach was packed this week in a good way. I mean, there were just lots of people down there early in the morning walking dogs, all during the day with kids and, you know, sun shelters and all that kind of thing. And then in the evening, bonfires on the beach and just lots of people sort of escaping the heat by getting close to Puget Sound. And all you have to do is walk ankle deep in Puget Sound and you're cooled off pretty easily. When it's 50 degree water.
I was going to say 54 at tops. You
know. Yeah, right. Nice. Yeah, Truman, what were your heat survival?
Well, you know, I'm originally from Texas, as you know. And so my thermometer is a little bit different. My wife hates me, you know, because it gets to be 90. And I'm going, yeah, this is great. But no, you know, by the way, I just have to say, we just finished our summer raffle, shopping spree at Thriftway. And I understand that we made our goal. So thank you very much, Vachon, for pitching in and helping us out. Craig and I had the last day at Thriftway. And we were out front, and of course, with my little back issue I've been having, I had sit. And of course, I'm sitting in the sun the whole time. And people kept coming up going, man, aren't you dying? I'm going, no, this is great. I'm loving it. And you know what? I didn't even get sunburned.
We put a little blanket over your legs and a babushka.
The little bonnet over my head.
And something, a tin can, I think, in order to.
Yeah, the tin cup out there. But anyway, the raffle is closed. The drawing will be this Friday during the first Friday on the street here, and they'll be doing it here in the studio. So I want folks to tune in for that. But anyway, that was the total of my experience.
All right. And Craig, were you out there in the sun with Truman, or were you seeking shade?
No, I was standing in the shade. Actually, there was a pillar, and I was trying to, I'm not narrow enough to totally fit in the shade that the pillar was giving me, but I was faring better than Truman was. But the way I did, my temperature range generally is about 68 to 70, very narrow. So I spent the hot weather laying on the concrete floor of our basement, not moving. Yeah. Not really. We've got a heat pump, too, that works like a dream. So we stayed nice and cool. The dogs stayed cool, and the cats and the horses were in the shade. So.
All right. I did. You know, that does remind me. And now there's no equivalence here. You reminded me of this. But on the hot days, the sun comes down on our deck, but we have potted plants out there and they're on little rollers. So they're up above the deck. Right. So there's like 2 or 3 inches underneath them. And the squirrels would come up on the deck looking for bird seed that had fallen. And when it was really hot, they would retire to underneath the rollers and literally spread eagle on the deck to cool off. Yeah. So a great technique. It's well known in nature, I guess.
Well, you know, I think it probably is the, the soil is going to remain fairly cool. And so it's got to be reasonably cool under there. Never thought of that, but interesting. Oh, yeah. Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Seth, any hot weather strategies you want to pass on other than just being calibrated in Texas like Truman?
Well, I spent some time as a kid growing up in the Middle East and was fond of quoting D.H. Lawrence, who said, "Only mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the noonday sun." So get inside in the shade, endure that time from about 1 to 6 when the temperature gets above 85 or got above 85 last week. And, it will cool off a little bit. Then trying to get to the sound, of course.
So we know that Truman's not an Englishman. So what does that leave?
He's a mad dog. No, but hey, I have to tell you, talking about being in the Middle East, I remember reading a thing. The son of an Arab guy says, "What, but father, why do we wear the full length robe?" And he explains, "Well, it's because the sun, And he asks him each of these items that he wears, why he wears them, and the turban, and all of these things. And the father goes through this big, long explanation at the end. The son says, "But dad, we live in Detroit." It's one of those,
Ba-boom.
Yeah. Yeah.
So 2 months out of the year, it's wardrobe appropriate.
There you go. Like. Yeah.
All right. Well, I also personally, and I think Seth, you and maybe all of us might agree that reforestation might be another great tactic for beating the heat. And given your role with the Northwest Natural Resources Group, I'd like you to let us know what the Northwest Natural Resources Group does. It sounds like we'd all something we'd like to have more of. And how did you get involved with the work, and what kind of focus do you have?
Sure. So it's kind of a mouthful. So we just usually call it NNRG. We promote ecological forestry in Washington and Oregon. And what I mean by that is forestry that isn't just aimed at creating more lumber or creating more return for investors, but looks holistically at the health of the forest and all the things that it can provide: lumber, jobs, clean water, carbon storage, wildlife habitat, spiritual solace, recreational opportunities, all of that. We do this both by conducting research, by doing providing workshops and educational materials, and actually helping landowners with the forests that they might own or have a stake in, writing management plans, overseeing timber harvest, removal of invasive species, reforestation if that's necessary. Often, with few exceptions, it seems like nature is pretty good at doing reforestation itself here, because there's so much precipitation most of the year that the seeds drop and you just got to stand back. But there are times when it can get taken over by salmonberry or blackberry, and you have to go in and actually help things get back to a forested condition.
Oh, interesting. And Truman?
I learned something. I think I talked about this once before, but I learned something interesting. I'm trying to think of the gentleman's name, but that'll come to me in a minute. But looking at my land, I have about 9.5 acres, and I have a lot of cedar trees. And he came out and took a look at it, and he said, "Oh, I see you've planted all these, I had all these sprouts coming up." He said, "Oh, I see you've planted all these cedars there." I said, no, I didn't plant those. He said, "Well, cedars don't self-propagate. You know, how are they growing here?" I said, "I have no idea." Well, finally, it dawned on us that I have horses, and the horses were chewing up the ground enough that it would plant those cedar trees. So have you encountered that? I mean, is this something that's normal, that cedars don't normally propagate?
Well, a lot of conifers like that bare mineral soil, even alders, you know, to get started in. There's so much, you know, everything is competing so strongly for light around here, that having some bare mineral soil where there's nothing growing right next to it will be really helpful for a seedling, because it'll turn into a huge tree. But when it starts out, it's, you know, less than an inch tall, and every photon is precious. Right. So that bare mineral soil for it to get started in is really helpful.
The other question about cedars is, I noticed that in the little cedar grove that I have in one part, there's the understory is very limited, do the cedars not allow the other stuff to grow? I mean, what's the deal? Or is it because of the shade? Or I'm curious about that.
It's hard to say without actually seeing the site, but some plants like cedars or redwoods or eucalyptus, they have oils that deter other things from growing. But it can also just be the out and out shade of the dense canopy that keeps anything else from getting started.
Just curious.
Yeah, I've heard that the tannins in the cedar, if I remember right, are one of those things that they put out. And similar, my situation is the larger cedars around our place also are quite clear underneath.
Right.
No other vegetation. Right. Well, hey, Seth, you're a Vashon Mori Islander, but the NNRG is based here on Vashon, or where are you based?
Our office is in Belltown. But we use it a lot less than we did before the pandemic. And as it is, you know, we've always been a pretty well geographically distributed organization. So we have foresters based in Olympia and Tacoma, as well as Seattle. We have forest techs in Puyallup and Hopium. We just go to wherever the forest is that needs us from where All we're right. closest by. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad that we had a chance to get together and talk, and that you're here for our small talk segment. So I'm glad we're on this topic. You mentioned one of the things that we talked about was an emphasis on older forests. And you mentioned earlier that there's a lot of factors that go into the advice that you give, right? The economics and the recreation and things like that. But there's also, of course, a high interest on Vashon about carbon sequestration. And I've always kind of speculated that older trees, you know, they're bigger around, they add a layer every year, and they've got to be storing more carbon per year than younger trees. But then I heard somebody say that no, younger trees are more vigorous in their growth, and they actually store more carbon than older trees. Do you know what the right answer is to that?
Well, this is a subject of great concern to us too. We think a lot about climate, both the way that forests affect the climate by storing carbon, and vice versa, the way the changing climate is going to affect the forests. When it comes to carbon storage and keeping carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, it is true that a young forest will sort of have its peak years of production from maybe age 20 to age 80 or 90. And at that point, the productivity of the forest starts to decline a little bit. It's really more useful to think about it in terms of carbon sequestration, and how much carbon the forest is pulling out of the air per acre instead of per tree, right? Because when a forest is, say, 40 years old, might have 200 or 250 trees to the acre, but by the time it's 100 or 150, it might only have 50 or 75 trees to the acre. And what's really limiting is the amount of forest land and growing space that we have. That being said, the industrial forestry practice of cutting trees down at age 40, which is kind of the way to maximize your return on investment, That's not very good for carbon storage because it cuts down the trees just as they're reaching into that those peak productive years in terms of carbon sequestration. You can see that a forest that's only 40 years old doesn't have very much carbon stored on the hoof, as it were. And it's not producing as much as it would if you let the forest reach their peak, you know, more their peak productive years, because then you're going to cut down the forest and all those photons are just going to be falling on bare soil for the first 5 or 10 years till the canopy closes in, and you're wasting all those all that light that could otherwise be sucking carbon out of the air. So we do, and the other thing to think about, of course, is that older forests are more resilient to climate change. You know, forests in their 20s, 30s, and 40s are really thirsty, and older forests being, you know, in with more developed fungal networks underground and, you know, being just older and who knows, perhaps wiser, can conserve their moisture more effectively than younger trees.
Fascinating stuff.
So,
hey, Truman.
Yeah, two things. So I would assume then the recommendation is to do a thinning, more of a, I mean, versus clear cutting, more of a selective harvest. And if so, how do you make that economically feasible when you're trying to be so careful and taking out the, you know, just the specific trees?
Yes, you're right that thinning is one of the techniques that we recommend, both because it allows the forest to keep on growing, and it mimics the process by which a, you know, natural forest, an untended forest, would go from many hundreds of trees to the acre to several dozen trees to the acre over time. What happens to the rest of those trees? Well, they could fall in the forest and decay, or you could pull them out a few at a time and send them off to the mill to build housing for people, which is obviously a dire need that we have currently in our society. You're also right that it costs a little bit more to log that way and to take the time to pull the trees out one at a time instead of just mowing down the whole swath. But over time, you can, you know, that's mitigated somewhat by the fact that you get greater productivity off the site, and also that it's producing these other goods that society cares about, like older forests, more carbon storage, better water quality, and so on. So, you know, we work with private landowners, with land trusts, with youth camps, with municipalities, who aren't just trying to maximize the rate of return on investment. It's you could think of raising older forests as something of a get-rich-slow scheme, where...
No, all right. And I think, full disclosure, Truman, you are, I believe, a member of the Vashon Forest Stewards.
I was for a number of years. I was on their board, yeah, a long time.
There you go. So definitely lots of great questions from that experience. Hey, one other thing that I think we should make sure to touch on, you know, I recall as we've now hearing about more wildfires, and particularly the protecting, you know, concerns even today about protecting the, you know, the giant sequoias. It's the wildfire season in California. It doesn't ever stop, is sort of where they're headed. And locally, the concern that was raised, right, about what our risk is. And like 5 years ago, I recall somebody saying, well, you know, we have enough rain here, not a problem, so don't worry too much about it. And then like a year or two later, Bonnie Lake caught on fire. So, right, we had a couple of major fires, Graham, Bonnie Lake. And I know that I've been on my property for 30 years, and you know, the trees that were living when I'm here are now thinning themselves out. Like you say, there's just fewer trees per acre. And I found that I had amazing amounts of dead standing fir trees on my property, which I've now removed. Is that the best way to go, Seth? What's the recommendation for us in this climate change that we're in to manage those forests we have, to preserve safety, but also preserve the forest?
Well, I think you have to think about it in two ways. One is what's called the wildland-urban interface, so the forest right around your house. And pretty much, you know, almost all of Vashon would be considered the wildland-urban interface because parcel sizes are small, houses are scattered all over. And so a lot of what we would care about from the standpoint of human habitation is making sure that even when the forest does catch on fire, as it will, that our houses and other key infrastructure can survive. So there's been a lot of work done, particularly in places with more frequent fires, in thinking about what are the best building materials to use and how far should you clear back the trees and things like that. Definitely a good idea if you have a lot of standing dead trees to clear some of them out. You want to leave a few for wildlife purposes, right? I mean, snags are incredibly important for bird nesting and so on, but you wouldn't want too many of them in your forest. Fire, you know, the people who've studied fire from, say, the Forest Service or universities here on the west side, a lot of these forests were born from fire, right? And that's how these older forests regenerated, was in large stand replacing fires that left snags but cleared the soil, and then a new cohort of trees got started. There's a huge fire, I think you were saying, and the materials were circulated before Bruce, right, around 1700. And those are bound to come again. So, and they're really a function of weather, is what fire scientists and forest ecologists have found, that when you get the combination of dry conditions, ignition, and hot east winds, that it becomes very hard to stop some of these fires. And they say that for the forest to regenerate on the sort of the scale of normal natural disturbance, you can expect fire sizes on the order of 25 to 250,000 acre patches to burn at once.
Wow.
Over a period. And so eventually that has to cover, you know, the millions of acres here on the west side over a period on average of 300 to 500 years. So you'll see, you know, there's the 1 year fire that, or the 10 year fire might be just some tens or hundreds of acres, but, you know, just like there's a 100 year flood, there's a 100 year fire, and that might be, you know, tens of thousands of acres.
Now, Bruce, you did circulate a history of fires on Vashon, and no surprise to our listeners that they understand that as the island historian, you've got all kinds of information and knowledge at your fingertips. Did you have any other perspective on that history of fires on Vashon?
Not really, other than that, you know, particularly from the 1920s, after Vashon had been logged in the 1880s to about 1910, 1915, you know, probably 80-90% of Vashon's log, you had incredible sort of wildfires virtually every year, particularly through the 20s and 30s, even up into the 1960s. By the 70s and 80s, that starts to suppress because the second growth forests are starting to become mature. And, you know, but my sense is, you know, we're not as immune from wildfires as people would like to think we are here in Western Washington. And you know, we had a very, very wet spring, so we're sort of living off of that as we go through this heat wave. But there have been summers that we've had extended droughts, and that's what leads to the potential of wildfires. And like Seth said, you know, if you haven't cleared around your house and a wildfire starts, you're in trouble. So there's a real history of wildfires on Vashon, but we just haven't experienced them in the last 30, 40 years to any big extent. But that doesn't mean they're not going to happen. Craig had a question, too.
Yeah. Well, I did. It's such a interdisciplinary issue, this issue of wildfires. And I was just curious how... you know, well-meaning environmental regulations perhaps are working against the best management sometimes of keeping fires under control and managing the forests. Everybody, has an interest and a well-meaning interest, but it seems that at times they work at odds with one another. Is that something that you've been dealing with, Seth?
Well, it's funny, you know, I'll confess that I moved here from California about 10 years ago. And in California, by contrast, it can take months and months, and you have to get a logging permit approved, and you have to do surveys for the spotted owl before you can move equipment in and all that stuff. Here in Washington State, it's $100 and it's 4 weeks and you're good to go. So I don't think that that's the case so much here.
Okay. Yeah. And then you've got the cultural issues of historic issues of years and years of fire being bad. You know, you've got the logging industry, of course, didn't want fires particularly. And then we grew up as kids with Smokey the Bear. Fire's bad. And now I guess we're learning that so-called prescriptive fires, as long as they don't get totally out of control, which they do on occasion, are good. So.
And, you know, it's very site and region and ecology specific. On the east side or farther south, you know, in Oregon and southern Oregon and northern California, really important to do these prescribed fires to keep fuel loads down, right? And they found at the Bootleg Fire in southwestern Oregon that having done that, actually, in the places where that was done, the fire intensity was greatly diminished because they'd been able to reduce the fuel loads, and so the fire didn't have as much to consume. And that's in what's called, that's in places where fire tends to return frequently and burn at low severity if it's properly managed, either because of lightning or indigenous management or because of ranchers were doing the same thing after they had displaced the native peoples. All these, you know, there's been a tradition of fire being used as a land management tool. But we're in a really different ecosystem here. And one of the foresters here on the island, Derek Churchill, who some of you may know, I'm sure Truman does. From his
that's who I was trying to think of a while ago.
you know, they talk about how there's just no point in trying to control fuel loads because everything grows back so fast. And mm-hmm. so instead, you know, you want to, it might make sense to do that around places where ignition is likely to occur, right? Because humans are the cause of most forest fires these days. So alongside roads, next to your house, you want to be able to suppress the fire before it would get into the wildland and get a jump on it. But I think it would be something of a fool's errand to try to keep fuel loads down in the forest that we have here.
So we're not going to be out raking the forest per Trump. Sorry, had to throw that out there. Hey, I just had one quick thing. You were talking about the history of fires here on Vashon. I have a very short story about that. October 30th in 1977 was the major fire here in downtown Vashon, where we lost 6 businesses and the pharmacy burned to the ground. And I mean, it was a big deal. We had firefighters coming over from the Burien area, I think. And anyway, at that particular time, I was a volunteer firefighter and here on the island. And we had plectrons, you know, little radios that would go off and alert you when there was a fire. Well, the reason I asked you the date on that, Bruce, was that was October 30th. My daughter was born July 10th. Of that same year. And so she was barely 3 months old. And being a volunteer firefighter, I had not had a whole lot of sleep since she was only 3 months old. And I had actually turned the volume down on my plectron. And even though it went off, I slept through that baby. In the morning, one of my friends whose husband's a firefighter, I mean, she called and said, "Well, are you going to take some food up to the firefighters?" And my wife goes, "What? What are you talking about?" We had no idea. So I of course, threw on my gear and was up there and putting out, you know, spot fires throughout about the next 24 hours working up there. But I missed the whole darn thing. I slept through it. So that's my story.
Lessons learned.
Indeed.
Well, hey, Seth, it's certainly, as you mentioned, so many people on Vashon and Maury Islands have an interest in the forest health and the climate change and the managing the forests for safety as well. How do people get in touch with you? How do they learn more? Northwest Natural Resources Group, what else can you tell people about how to reach you?
I'd say in these modern days, just visit us on the web, nnrg.org. We have also a YouTube channel. If you look up Northwest Natural Resource Group, it's actually resource singular. And it has all kinds of tips, including how to cut down a tree more safely, one of our more popular videos, as well as ways to build habitat piles to encourage wildlife to use your forest, and so on and so forth. So,
just a quick question. I know that King County has the PBRS. Is it at the right PBR? Anyway, the public benefit program where you can put your land on this program, and it saves you quite a bit of tax dollars. But to do that, don't you have to have your managed forest as well?
You have to create a management plan for your forest, and we do that. If you're in need of one, we have foresters who can write one of those for you. And the advantage is you get taxed that part of your land, not your homestead or your house site, but the rest of it is taxed just on its value for forest land, not on its value for development.
And I guess the other question is then, once you do that and you have that plan, then you have to maintain that. And do those folks get paid to do those plans, or how do they come about?
You can either hire us to do one of those plans. If you don't want to get it done right away, the USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service has a cost share program called EQIP, Environmental Quality Incentives Program, which will defray half the cost of a slightly more elaborate plan that will also talk more about soils and wildlife and really set you up with a schedule of what to do over the next 30 years in your forest. So a couple different options, different ways to go that way.
And that, of course, leads to the last question for me is, where does your funding come from? I mean, you folks aren't doing this all altruistically. I mean, how do you make money, and where does your funding come from?
Well, I mean, it is a little bit altruistically in the sense that we're driven by a passion for improved forest management in here in Washington and Oregon, but it does take money to dedicate our time to this. About a quarter of it comes from foundation grants, a quarter from government grants, and about half from the work we do directly for landowners, some private benefit earned income work that we do to help people on their own land. And that helps sustain our crew of foresters who are out there painting trees for cutting and marking riparian boundaries so that the streams get left in good condition after the loggers come by.
Great.
Fantastic. Well, hey, Seth, I know that we had a chance to cross paths at the four-way stop in town, and that conversation led to you jumping into small talk today. So appreciate the fact that you're able to join us.
No, you go. Thanks so much, Kevin, and everyone else for having us.
Absolutely. You're welcome to stay. We're going to do some chit-chatting about a few other things, but if you have other things you want to get off to, we fully understand. But you're welcome to stay with us. Another local Vashon issue, and we're just talking about forest health and fire danger, and of course our Charles Krimmert, our former police chief, is now fire chief. Thank you. I said police, didn't I?
You did.
Thank you. Former fire chief. Mr. Krimmert was in the news quite a lot over the course of the last couple of years. What do you think? Is it Vashon's loss, or is it sort of it's about time? Anyone want to hazard an opinion?
We're just wading in on these issues, aren't we? I normally have
just curious. I have an opinion, but what do you guys think?
Yeah, I normally have an opinion on everything, but I don't know if I have an educated one on that. I've talked to both firemen and people who've worked in the emergency services, and the opinions on that one are all over the board. Obviously, he got some bad press, which he was primarily responsible for regarding the vaccination issues. I can't really say in terms of whether or not, that had an effect on his being or his leaving the fire department.
Well, it's essentially, it's not an either or, it's a both. he's certainly a loss to the community in terms of his leadership with the EOC and the COVID response. It's certainly about time to go in terms of his reaction to the vaccination kind of thing. And to me, it's a measure of how far we've come in terms of, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, people would have just looked the other way at unacceptable behavior, particularly among older male leaders. That's no longer the case, you know, and there's lots of reasons for that. And so, you know, to be a leader today, you have to be both. You have to be, you know, impeccably, you know, sort of lead an impeccable kind of life outside of work as well as in work. And Charlie's a great guy and did a lot for the fire department in terms of bringing it under fiscal control and developing sort of management systems for it. But he also was a volatile personality, you know, and in this world today, you can't be both.
I don't know about that, Bruce. You don't have to look too far to find an example of somebody who may not meet those qualifications that yeah. That you made reference to that has served in the highest offices.
Yeah, but there's a different criteria there. he's not hired by a board.
That's true. Darn it.
Okay.
It's too bad.
Exactly. We'll
too
see. Bad. We'll see how well he does coming up in the next year. It'd be quite entertaining and interesting, I suspect. But good point. I've heard both praise as well as concern regarding the former fire chief. But I have to say that during the whole issue regarding the apparent hypocrisy, I would say, regarding his willingness to be vaccinated, to me, that spelled the end of his leadership potential on the island. I think he lost a lot there. But Bruce, thanks for putting in perspective all the demands that are placed on our leaders today. It's not a simple road to walk. I completely understand that. And Mr. Krimit did wonderful things, but he didn't do everything right, I guess.
As a member of the board of Vashon, Voice of Vashon, I have to say that he did a really wonderful job working with us on our whole antenna issue around the cell tower and stuff. We had major issues with AT&T and, you know, the blocking of our signal and yada, yada, yada. And he was very, very helpful in working with us on that. So I have to appreciate that portion of the work that he did. So officially.
Fantastic. Always good for some good call outs. Anybody who's touched our lives on Vashon Mori Island oftentimes brings good things to us. And a healthy fire department is certainly a critical asset for us here. Right. So today is an interesting day. There's a couple things that are happening today, but one is it's the time to vote for us in our Washington state and four other states. So make sure that those ballots, which of course do not require a stamp, they do require that they be dropped in the drop box at the Vashon Library, I believe by 8 o'clock, but you might have until 9. I'm not positive about that, but don't wait that late. And drop it in the mailbox. Best to go to the post office so that it gets postmarked. It's actually better to do that earlier today than later. So to make sure, because even though you can claim the ballot just has to be postmarked, we want to make sure that it gets there early enough for the post office to actually do that. So that's the public service announcement. But the question is, so we have a retiring state representative, Eileen Cody, and there's a few folks who are definitely lining up to replace her. Any idea of what are your thoughts about the two leading candidates to replace Eileen Cody?
I don't know anything about the candidates, but I do know that Eileen was absolutely wonderful to work with. And when I was with the Vashon Community Care Center, she was fantastic and was very, I don't know what the word is, but just was a delight to work with. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm sorry to see her go.
Mm-hmm. Truly. And we also then in the state on your ballots, there will be Steve Hobbs is the incumbent now for Secretary of State, only because Kim Wyman, our former Secretary of State, was elevated to, she took a job with the administration. And so Steve Hobbs, former State Senate Transportation Committee Chair and a person of color in Snohomish County, is on the ballot for Secretary of State. And his main opponent is running as an independent, as opposed to somebody who's associated with a political party. Any comments or thoughts about Secretary of State race?
Well, I'm always a little wary of individuals who talk about really working on election, validity, security, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. My understanding is that a lot of that plays into the big lie. I'm inclined to, obviously those are important factors, but I think our elections in Washington are exemplary. And I'd like to continue to see them carried on that way. And the methods of voting in this state are excellent. And so I'm kind of happy with the status quo, to tell you my personal opinion.
You know, along those lines, you guys are always asking me about my Army buddies, some of the further right-leaning folks that are friends of mine. And and several of them have said, "Oh, that mail-in voting thing, you know, that's just completely fraudulent." Blah blah blah, quoting Trump, where that came from. And I have to tell them, "Hey, folks, you have no idea what you're talking about, because here in Washington State, we've been doing it for a long time, and we have it absolutely secure. What the minor fraud happens is usually it's just mistakes that people have made." But just virtually not non-existent. So.
Mm-hmm. You know, and Gail, go ahead, Bruce.
Oh, I think this election will be really interesting. You know, as Craig said, and Truman, Washington State has an exemplary voting system. Mail-in voting, you can go to the polls. There's just lots of opportunities to vote, very easy to vote. And my sense is what will be interesting in this election is Hobbs is a very strong candidate, but his major opponent, who's running as an independent, is creating a message about sort of keeping that control of the voting out of the hands of political parties. And so it'll be interesting how that resonates with voters. Like Craig and Truman, I'm very happy with the system we have. I did vote for Hobbs because I think he's done a good job. He stepped in when Wyman left. He's got a strong background. But I was intrigued by his opponent's sort of independent sort of approach to it. And it'll just be interesting to see how that resonates with voters around the state.
I'm kind of with you, Bruce. I feel more comfortable with the primary party who seems to be advocating for voting rights to have the seat as our Secretary of State. But that's just me, but I'm biased. hey, maybe the last thing we should cover before we go, setting new standards in adventure travel, Nancy Pelosi has now traveled to Taiwan and apparently has escaped the risk of being shot down by the Chinese. She was en route. But here we are now looking at U.S.-China naval escalation, Taiwan military practices. Meanwhile, of course, we have Russia. What are we looking at here in terms of global saber rattling? Is this something we should pay attention to? Is this just part of normal discourse these days? Bruce, maybe I should ask what your thoughts are.
Well, I think it's far from normal. it's sort of the breaking of the post-World War II Pax Americana being broken down. Certainly the Cold War, it was intense in sort of local regional wars. But what we're seeing, I think, is the emergence of sort of a tripartite division in the world between the Soviet Union, what was the Soviet Union, Russia and its compatriots, China, and sort of the Western alliance. And, it sort of echoes what you saw in Brave New World with the sort of, the conflict between these three sort of major world powers. And so I think it's far from normal of what we've seen over the last 70 years. Where it will go, it's a little hard to tell, but my sense is it's not normal, and it's only going to escalate.
Well, on that cheery note, I'm afraid that we are out of time, guys. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And we will see you all next week. Huh?
All right. And one last quick note, at 9 o'clock tonight, Voice of Vashon, Shasti Conrad, the chair of the King County Democrats, is going to talk about the importance of maintaining Democratic majorities in Washington. Tune in at 9 o'clock for the Progressive Vashon podcast and hear Shasti Conrad's thoughts. Thanks, Truman.
All right. See you all next week.
Y'all next week.
Bye now.